Imagine a series of islands, an archipelago ruled by magic, where weather workers make wind for the ships and court sorcerers entertain the monarchs. Or imagine an ice world, where no one has a gender at all, except for a few days every month, and the words, "the king is pregnant," make perfect sense. These are just some of the imaginary worlds of Ursula Le Guin, one of the best-loved authors of science fiction and fantasy in the world. She's 85 years old, and she's still publishing. A wide and deep thinker, humane, concerned with race and culture, politics and spirituality, she's been writing since the 1960s, and she still has the power to surprise.
I am a man. Now, you may think I made some kind of silly mistake about gender, or maybe that I'm trying to fool you because my first name ends in A, and I own 3 bras, and I've been pregnant 5 times, and other things like that that you might have noticed, little details. When I was born, there actually were only men. People were men. They all had one pronoun, his pronoun. So that's who I am. I'm the generic he, as in, if anybody needs an abortion, he will have to go to another state. Or, a writer knows which side his bread is buttered on. That's me, the writer, him.
She is willing to change the landscape of your head with her ideas, and there is such power in that.
Neil Gaiman, best-selling fantasy author.
It is that power of things could be different, and that is a weapon that Ursula deploys with aplomb, with verve, and she throws out ideas like a terrorist setting off a bomb.
Quite simply, Ursula Le Guin is one of the reasons I'm here talking on the radio now.
Booker shortlisted author David Mitchell.
She's one of the reasons why I'm a writer, because as a kid, the Earthsea Trilogy, as it was then, was the first book that whacked me in the guts viscerally and made me think, I want to do that. I want to do to other people what she's just done to me. I want to write these immersive books which people read, and while they're in that world, it is more real than the room they're reading the book in.
Because my sort of awakening as a feminist was so tied primarily to her books.
Karen Joy Fowler, novelist and friend of Ursula Le Guin.
It's hard for me to separate out the two or to imagine what I would have thought eventually if she hadn't been the road that I was using to get there.
I'm perfectly willing to admit that I may be, in fact, a kind of second-rate or imitation man, a pretend to him. What it comes down to, I guess, is that I'm just not manly, like Ernest Hemingway was manly. The beard and the guns and the wives and the little short sentences. Ernest Hemingway would have died rather than have syntax or semicolons. I use a whole lot of half-assed semicolons. There was one of them just now. That was a semicolon after semicolons and another one after now. And another thing, Ernest Hemingway would have died rather than get old. And he did. He shot himself. A short sentence. And that brings up the real proof of what a mess I have made of being a man. I'm not even young. Just about the time they finally started inventing women, I started getting old. And I went right on doing it, shamelessly. I have allowed myself to get old, and I haven't done one single thing about it, with a gun or Botox or anything.
She sets a bar that I remember to look at. She's there as sort of almost like a patron saint. I've appointed her. I hope she doesn't mind. But Saint Ursula is kind of my writerly patron saint. I've never admitted that to anyone, but here I am doing it.
I first encountered Ursula Le Guin's work in her children's Earthsea novels. I don't think I realised then how deeply well-realised the worlds of the books are. Le Guin has an anthropologist's eye for her fantasy realms. Which makes sense. She was born in 1929 in Berkeley, California, the youngest daughter of the writer Theodora Kroeber and anthropologist Alfred L. Kroeber.
It was a university professor's family in a university town in the 1930s and 40s when there were a lot of refugees from Europe. So I probably knew more foreigners and more Indians than most middle-class white American children do. And more people who came and visited from unusual places, the South Seas or up in the Arctic and so on, because they'd been doing field work there. I think I was very lucky. It was a very privileged childhood. America is rather its own place, and an awful lot of Americans at that time had never met or seen or thought very much about anything but other Americans rather like themselves.
Do you think that's had a lasting impact on your work?
Yeah, I do. I'm completely at home with and interested in people who are not like myself. And also, I think probably I simply share some of my father's temperament that led him into anthropology. This interest in how people do things and why they do them that way.
Alfred Kroeber, Le Guin's father, is most noted for his work with a man called Ishi, the last member of the Native American tribe, the Yahi. Ishi's entire people had been wiped out, and when he knew himself to be the only survivor, he wanted his history and culture to be recorded. It was to Alfred Kroeber that Ishi told his stories, and it was Le Guin's mother, Theodora, who in 1964 published a biography of Ishi, The Last of His Tribe.
The whole Ishi story was before I was born, and my father never talked about Ishi. I think the whole thing was very painful to him still. Ishi died of tuberculosis after only a few years among the whites. And so many, many, many Indians had died of white diseases. Most of the Indian population of California was dead before the whites really settled heavily because of white diseases to which they had no immunity. And my father had worked with remnants of tribes for years, and he and Ishi had been personal friends, and so I think the whole thing was just pretty hard. He was not a man who liked to reminisce and talk about old times either, so I never heard anything about Ishi until my mother started writing the book, essentially. But the situation of a man being the last of his people, being alone among strangers all the rest of his life, it's a kind of Robinson Crusoe thing, but an awful lot of my stories involve a character who is the only one of his or her kind. Now, of course, it's also occurred to me that all adolescents feel that way. You know, there isn't anybody else like me, and I am alone in this awful world with these weird rules that I don't understand. And it's also a very science fictional situation.
And a very painful situation. It's interesting that your father found it too painful to talk about. My mother had introduced that story to me. I'm Jewish, and I think a lot of Jewish people have a connection with that story because knowing yeah. that...
Knowing what, genocide.
Yeah, knowing yeah. genocide.
It's amazing how many Americans still resist the fact that we committed genocide quite deliberately in places like California.
Mm. Do you think that we and American society is still living with the remnants of that experience, that which was done?
Well, all the Indians in America are very much living with it. The issues are still alive. But, you know, America is a very racist country, so it's not just the Indians.
You've written about Ishi that his people didn't tell other people their name, and there was no one to do it for him. So he and my father, Alfred Kroeber, agreed to use a word which they understood to mean, in Ishi's language, simply man.
Well, yeah, there are a good many Native American peoples who do not like to speak their own name, or it can be rather rude to have their name spoken. Names are powerful. There's a whole branch of magic, after all, in many, many cultures, which is naming magic. If you know the true name of the thing, you have power over the thing or the person. That's the basic magic I used in Earthsea. It seems to go pretty deep in human psychology.
Your characters have true names, which they must not reveal to other people.
Right. If they reveal them, they're simply putting themselves in that person's power. And if the person has evil intentions, that's a very stupid thing to do.
Earthsea is still the finest ever story about sending a boy to wizard school. And the magic of Earthsea feels right. There was a moment in my last novel, Ocean at the End of the Lane, where I wrote a passage and then looked at the passage and thought, you know, this is absolutely me, absolutely ripping off Ursula Le Guin. And then I thought about it for a moment. I thought, you know, not really ripping her off, because she formed the way that I think about the world. She built the idea of magic in my head, and this is her magic. It was a way of addressing the world in a language that it could not ignore, and the language itself made the world real. And of course, the way that Ursula writes, her language does make the world real.
Oh, it does indeed. And after all, I mean, what we do as novelists, we are simply, by naming invented things, we are causing them to exist in other people's minds. We have an awful responsibility, don't we? It's fun, too.
She's such an unflashy stylist that they aren't sentences that halt you in your tracks because of the pyrotechnics of their wordplay. They're sentences that sort of halt you in your tracks because they're so achingly true. As their eyes met, a bird sang aloud in the branches of the tree. In that moment, Ged understood the singing of the bird and the language of the water falling in the basin of the fountain, and the shape of the clouds and the beginning and end of the wind that stirred the leaves. It seemed to him that he himself was a word spoken by the sunlight. Wow. Wow, that does it to the hairs on my neck now, and I've read this over 10 times.
One might suspect that to be this prolific, Le Guin would have had to live the life of a hermit, but not a bit of it. She has 3 children, 4 grandchildren, and she and her husband, the historian Charles Le Guin, have been married for more than 60 years. It was as students that they first met.
Oh, well, now that we managed that really, really well. We were both Fulbright students going to France, and they put us on the Queen Mary to go over. And the first night out, Charles and I, we were the oldest kids in our group, I think. So we ended up in the bar together. I don't think anybody else even drank, you know. So there we were in the bar of the Queen Mary. And by the time we got to France, I was madly in love. And I think it took Charles a day or two longer. But anyway, we got married in Paris that winter. And the Fulbright people were awfully nice about it. The French weren't, but there was always another tax stamp that we needed somewhere across the city.
And so it's never been an issue for you, the idea of being both a writer and a wife and a mother.
Oh, sure, it was an issue. Oh, yeah. I mean, you don't have 3 kids without finding that your writing time is somewhat limited. For many years, while the kids were little, I wrote after 9 o'clock at night only. But, okay, that's how it was. I wanted to have the kids. I was glad I had them. And so I just had 2 jobs. I had the kind of support that counts most from Charles always, which was help with the housework if I needed it and bringing up the kids. We figured that one person really can't do 2 jobs. It's terribly hard. The cost is awful. But 2 people can do 3 jobs. So he had his teaching, and I had my writing, and we had the kids. So the kids, of course, is where the sharing took place.
And ideas around gender equality were part of Le Guin's life even earlier than that.
I always thought of my mother as being kind of a feminist. And she gave me 3 guineas to read when I was an adolescent. Now, that's pretty strong meat for the 1940s. Virginia Woolf's 3 Guineas, which is a very angry book. And I ate it up. Then when the women's movement really got going again in the 70s, my mother declared firmly that she'd never been a feminist, which was disturbing to me, but I had to kind of re-educate myself as a writer, to write as a woman. The little piece I wrote about I Am a Man, that's what that is about. In order to be taken seriously as a writer, you more or less had to write as a man about things that interested men. I pretended to be a man in my writing for many years because writing was male. That has changed a lot in my lifetime.
At a time when I was trying to think about how things might be different, she offered me visions of things that were so much more different.
Reading The Left Hand of Darkness when I was 11 years old changed everything that I would think about gender because suddenly, for me, gender had become unmoored. It no longer had the same incredibly important binary quality. The idea that gender could become fluid, that you didn't have to read a story and go, this character is male, this character is female. The idea that a king could give birth, it changed my head.
Being a gendered being is a very complicated business. And that's, of course, one of the enormous things that has changed during the second half of my lifetime, is that we now admit that gender is not just binary, that it is a whole spectrum. And this is becoming more and more accepted, even in the United States. And it's wonderful.
I really love your story, The Matter of Segre, which is about a society in which there are so few men. It's something like only one in every 16 births is a male birth. So the men are very highly prized as sexual objects, as reproductive objects, whereas the women are the ones who do the work, who have the money, who receive the education. There's a character who has lived her life really according to the rules of the society, but there's been a very tragic outcome. And the line is, she thought, my life is wrong, but she did not know how to make it right. And I wondered if you think that in matters of gender, we live in a wrong society still.
Oh, yes. I mean, things have changed in some respects enormously in Europe and America, but Europe and America are only one part of the world, and race and gender are going to bedevil us for a long time to come, I'm afraid.
However a society is organized in your work, there's always some element of things being unsatisfactory.
Yeah, well, the Buddha would have something to say about that, after all. That you know, existence cannot be entirely satisfactory. That is its nature.
If you were to think about the future of the women's movement and of gender in our world, what are your hopes?
Well, I hope that we don't backslide. My country, where I live, is at this moment in a curious regressive mood. Apparently people are frightened, and so they want to go back to what they perceive as the old certainties. And of course, among this is putting women back in their place. And it worries me when I see young women who aren't worried about this and who think they've sort of got it made, you know. But I really have to say, Naomi, at my age, at 85, I don't think it's particularly my job to look ahead. I think the perspective from where I am in really extreme old age is, how much of the future can it include? Or should it include? I mean, it's really not my business anymore. It's your business and the young'uns.
I have this wonderful feeling with all of your invented worlds where they feel like they go right off the page. The planet O, for example, you have this wonderful funeral service where they say, now all that was owed is repaid and all that was owned returned. Now all that was lost is found and all that was bound free. And I felt like I read this and I thought, I wanted to go and get the rest of that prayer book. It feels like it exists. So I wanted to sort of talk in quite a technical way about how it is. How do you go about constructing your worlds?
The best way I can answer that question ever is to say it is more like a process of discovery. I go there and look around and wait and see what I see. And I am really learning the places as I live there, as it were. Often I have glimpsed the character and the place, but that's it. It's just a glimpse. And then my job is to find out who that person is and where they are and what they're doing there, which, of course, always means connections and relationships. Morning is my time to write. It always was. From beginning to wake up, before I'm awake, was often a very fruitful time with thinking about the novel, seeing where it went next, what was going to happen. And if that can go through breakfast, and then I could sit down with the notebook or the computer or whatever the current technology was, then, you know, then I could do a couple of hours of writing. The way I do it, increasingly as I can trust myself as a writer, is to sort of get it going and be sure I know where it's going and then just let it go. My last novel, Lavinia, about a character from Virgil's Aeneid, I was plugging along, relearning Latin in old age and plugging my way slowly through the Aeneid. And Lavinia began, she addressed me, as it were, what it seemed I've done. I don't mean I'm Joan of Arc hearing voices, you know, but some characters seem to simply present themselves to you and demand that you let them speak. I know who I was. I can tell you who I may have been, but I am now only in this line of words I write. I'm not sure of the nature of my existence and wonder to find myself writing. As far as I know, it was my poet who gave me any reality at all. It was he who brought me to life, to myself, and so made me able to remember my life and myself, which I do vividly with all kinds of emotions. Emotions I feel strongly as I write, perhaps because the events I remember only come to exist as I write them, or as he wrote them. But he didn't write them. He slighted my life in his poem. He scanted me, because he only came to know who I was when he was dying. He grieved for that, I know. He grieved for me. Perhaps where he is now, down there across the dark rivers, somebody will tell him that Lavinia grieves for him. So, that's where it all started.
Imagining you writing that, it feels like you're almost possessed by the spirit of this character.
Exactly, yeah. You do have to sort of consider the word possession, yes.
Her books just have that capacious quality for me, and there's new things to find in them. And new discoveries to be made. They're kind of infinite. They don't date. They're written with such fierce intelligence and philosophy and anthropology and sociology and politics. They're underpinned by thought.
Coming back to being the anthropologist's daughter, I knew, perhaps more clearly than many kids, that there were different ways to do almost everything. That there wasn't just one right way, and God did not ordain it to be such and so forever, which can be an awful trap, you know. So that, I don't know whether it's hope or optimism, but just the sense of freedom that you can get by saying it does not have to be this way.
I think my favorite moment in anything Ursula has done, I don't think a year has ever gone by without me going back and rereading it, is probably the short story, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelus. I try and understand how she did it. I look at the tense she writes it in, the kinds of words, the way she begins something as a thought experiment, the way she builds it up in your head, and then the way she breaks your heart. And I go, if I could just do that. And I can't tell how she does it, because she begins by telling you that nothing in this story is real. And that's not just like a master craftsman. It's like a magician.
Do you believe? Do you accept the festival, the city, the joy? No? Then let me describe one more thing. In a basement, under one of the beautiful public buildings of Omelas, or perhaps in the cellar of one of its spacious private homes, there is a room. It has one locked door and no window. The floor is dirt, a little damp to the touch, as cellar dirt usually is. In the room, a child is sitting. The door is always locked, and nobody ever comes, but the child, who has not always lived in the room and can remember sunlight and its mother's voice, sometimes speaks. I will be good, it says. Please let me out. I will be good.
The idea comes directly from William James, and Dostoevsky used it in Brothers Karamazov. So it's not my idea. I just fleshed it out as a story. Would you make, if the bargain is that everybody can be happy and things can be really good, if one person, just one person, pays for it? And the person can be kind of hidden away, so you don't have to see it happening. Would you accept it? William James very touchingly says, of course we wouldn't. But I'm afraid we do, constantly.
They all know it's there, all the people of Omelas. They all know it has to be there. They all understand that their happiness depend wholly on this child's abominable misery.
You wrote that story in 1973, and I wondered if you thought we're getting closer to Omelas or we're getting further away.
Neither. Well, at the moment, I would say that social injustice is rather worse in my country than it was when I was, let's say it. Around the Reagan administration, we began to accept more social injustice as perfectly tolerable and to kind of lose the idea of trying to make things fair for everybody. And I think in some ways we have backtracked rather badly. In fact, I know we have. And that's what the story is about, in a way. Who has to suffer so that other people can be happy?
One of the things that you point up in that story is that this society with only joy just doesn't feel real to us. And I wondered why that is.
Well, I guess we all have a certain streak of realism.
There's a line in Tehanu where you say, "Who will ask the darkness its name? I will." Is that a way of taking power from the darkness?
Yes. Yeah, that says it very nicely, I think. Yeah. Tanar, in a sense, is speaking for reason and human courage there.
Do you think your novels are a way of negotiating with the darkness, or at least bringing the darkness to our attention?
Often, yes. Yes. Yeah. It does serve both to bring the darkness, if it's been neglected, and the light to our attention. You know, all art is not tragic. There is comedy. There'd better be.